From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about wild horses. A ragged, ferocious Mustang tearing through the sagebrush is one of the most iconic images for the West. But the journalist David Phillips says today's wild horses are stuck in a world between wild animals and livestock, and here in the West, we don't really know what to do with them. Phillips has written a book where he explores the history and the future of the Mustang. We'll be right back. Hey, listeners, I'm hoping you'll take a moment to go see the second film in our new series called Habitat. It features the retired designer and architect Bob Bliss. Bob's Craftsman House in Salt Lake City reflects his own aesthetic, but it's also filled with the paintings of his wife, the late Anna Campbell Bliss. Anna died in 2015, but Bob keeps her memory alive in the home they made together. Go see it at RadioWest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The history of wild horses in the West is deeper than you think. And what you think, what most of us think, is horses arrived in North America with the Spanish. And it's true, of course. The version of the horse we all think of didn't show up here until the Spanish explorers and conquistadors did. But the journalist David Phillips' book is a history that stretches back, like way back, 50 million years back, when the West was more like a jungle and the earliest horses were the size of sheep. These days, the federal government has been struggling to manage the number of horses. They keep rounding them up and warehousing them. But Phillips says we're at a point where we need to make a call. Either find a way to live with these wild creatures and the wildness they require, or forever lose one of the last untamed parts of the West. David Phillips is a Pulitzer Prize-winning national reporter for the New York Times. His book is called Wild Horse Country: The History, Myth, and Future of the Mustang. Phillips, we should say, is not a horse person. He doesn't own any. He's only ridden them a few times when he was a kid back in summer camp. But he says he wanted to learn about wild horses, not because he loves wild horses, but because he loves wildness.
I honestly was well into my adulthood, having grown up in the West, before I even really knew that there were wild horses in the West. And not just a couple, but many thousand roaming, you know, hundreds of thousands of acres. So that struck me with utter surprise. And I wanted to know, you know, what in our history, in our mythology as a nation, allowed this to happen, where it's happened almost nowhere else on the planet.
Yeah.
And when I say allows this to happen, what I mean is this. We spend tens of millions of dollars each year to round up wild horses and control them, their populations, with contracted helicopters and corrals and freight trucks. And we have this whole system that over a generation has cost us $1 billion to control something that's supposed to be wild and free. And to me, that was so striking that I wanted to know what was the groundwork laid to make that happen, and is there any way out of it?
You went to this roundup in Sand Springs Valley that you write about early on in the book because you wanted to know, and this is how you put it in the book, how wildness on such a scale could persist at a time when everything seems increasingly penned in. Say something about that, because that is the contrast here, it seems, for the West.
Right, right. So when I first learned that there were wild horses, I thought that there was just a couple, you know, curated in some national park somewhere, mm-hmm. carefully guarded. And it turns out that no, the wild horses that exist really exist despite us trying to control them. They are really free and really wild and roam the West like coyotes or antelope do. And that was amazing to me just because we in America, of course, we all know the plight of large mammals in this world in the last century, and it hasn't been good. And so how is it that we could have, you know, herds of thousands of large mammals that are out there roaming and free, you know, in a place as developed and increasingly crowded as the United States.
There's this theme, I think, that you keep coming back to in the book, and because you write about how horses, wild horses, Mustangs, are like no other animal in America, not just biologically, you say, but, and this seems crucial, culturally. And it seems like there's this myth idea that you refer to from time to time, that we love a wild horse. We love a white stallion, for example, for certain reasons. And one of them is because it cannot be caught, because of that sense of independence. And that's an idea that it seems like in some ways kind of undergirds the story here.
Right. I didn't realize this until actually years into my reporting on this book, that in trying to preserve wild horses, we as a country were trying to preserve an idea of independence that really was the embodiment of ourselves. And let me tell you what I mean.
Yeah.
So if you think of the revolutionary period of American history as our genesis of our creation story, then the expansion into the West, the cowboy era, is our exodus. It is the journey that made us who we are and bound us together as a people. And the animal that embodies that is the wild horse. It is, in a real big way, the American mascot. And I know officially the American mascot is the bald eagle, but that's really more a symbol of federal power. Whereas as the horse, if you think about it, is us. It's an immigrant, like almost all of us are. The wild horse gets its strength and its nobility not from any fancy lineage, but simply from the grit of having made it in this land. Mm. It is a animal that we value because it will not submit. It is independent. So in a way, it is like us.
Yeah.
You know, what it values most is liberty.
You also say these horses are kind of stuck in this weird limbo place in between being a wild animal and being thought of as livestock.
Yeah, that's right. So wild horses came to North America with the Spanish and from lots of other sources. All the wild horses that are roaming the West now are a mishmash of American horses, English horses, Spanish horses, you name it. Some have been roaming wild for 500 years. Some have been roaming wild maybe for 5 years. So it's a mix. But what makes them hard to define is that they are a free-roaming, wild-living animal. But, you know, technically they are an invasive species in a lot of ways. They're feral. And so they don't have a lot of the rights of native animals. For example, they cannot be protected under the Endangered Species Act. Even though they live a life very much like other wild animals. So it puts them into this gray area where no one really knows what to make of them.
You mentioned this idea that they're an invasive species. You went to northwestern Wyoming, to desert country there, the Bighorn Basin. Pretty, I don't want to say desolate, but pretty uninhabited. And you went there in July. It was hot.
Mm.
And explain the argument here. Mustangs are thought of as non-native. And we'll get to the dispute on that question here in a moment. But the idea is that they throw off the balance of a native ecosystem.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that. This idea that they're invasive, that they don't
right.
really belong here.
Yeah. So they are the grazing version of kudzu in a lot of people's minds. You know, they came in from another ecosystem far away, and so there are no checks and balances on them. And if they are allowed to spread and thrive in this ecosystem in the West, then they are displacing the natives. So that is one of the reasons that people have argued that wild horse herds need to be carefully limited or in some cases totally removed. So I got really interested in that idea of what is native and how do you define it? And for wild horses, that's really tricky, as I found out when I went to the Bighorn Basin, because before they were introduced with the Spanish conquistadors, they had been here for literally tens of millions of years. So the reason that I went to the Bighorn Basin is it is one of the places, the top places in the world where mammal fossils are preserved. And in this area where essentially a rainforest had been preserved in the rock record, you would find thousands and thousands and thousands of fossilized remains of the very first horses. It was in this area of North America that horses got their start and that they evolved from about 55 million years ago on into all sorts of shapes and sizes. You could imagine sort of a Serengeti type of situation where you had big grazing horses and little grazing horses and ones that filled niches where they browsed on bushes and others that lived out in the open. And they're just all sorts. And what's interesting for me is they thrived for 55 million years. And then about 15,000 years ago, right when humans showed up in North America, they very quickly disappeared. And so that leads the question, if, as a lot of evidence suggests, they were native here for millions of years before they were hunted to extinction by humans, and then they returned only a few thousand years later, are they invasive or are they native? And that's a question I explored, and of course there's no easy answer. But I think you can argue that the land still has a memory for them, both the grasses and the other animals. And so that led me to think about their place in the West in a whole different way.
I like the idea, which we'll come to later, about the predators there. Ancient predators may have a memory as well for them.
It is striking, if you think in geological terms, of how short this 10,000 or 15,000 year gap is.
Yeah.
So if you condense the history of the wild horse in North America to a single day, they would have been thriving here on the land until about 17 seconds before midnight. And then they would disappear, only to show up again with the Spanish in the very last second of the day. And so the question is, that 16 seconds that they were gone, you know, stretched over geologic time, does it matter? And I think that there's a lot of scientific evidence that suggests that it does not.
I loved this part of the idea of trying to think back 50 million years to the Bighorn Basin, comparing what it's like now to what it was then. You know, it was basically a kind of a steamy jungle, and trying to imagine these small little horses running around, because you say there were a lot of them. They basically dominated the forest, these little horses in those days.
Yeah, and the horse at the time, you would have looked at it and not maybe noticed that it was a horse. It didn't have that deep jaw and that big, long muzzle. It had a little bit of a humped back, and it may have even bounded a little bit rather than galloped. And importantly, it didn't have one hoof. It had four in the front and three in the back.
Yeah.
And so just as the land slowly changed, how the land became drier, how grasses spread, the horse slowly changed to fit the land, to be a runner in the open land, to have a deep jaw with big teeth that could handle this harsh grass of the West. They really, very slowly changed shape to fit each other.
David Phillips. His book is called Wild Horse Country, The History, Myth, and Future of the Mustang. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
They say all politics is local, and KUER reporters are here to bring you Utah stories, news that affects you here at home, like public lands and water issues, religion, and the tech boom. You can trust KUER to bring you the facts and thoughtful analysis of why the story matters. Listen to KUER on air at 90.1, stream us at KUER.org, and here's a pro tip. If you've got a smart speaker, tell it you want to listen to NPR, and Alexa or Google will take you right there.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Phillips about wild horses. He has a book that examines how wild horses these days have become stuck in this world between wild animals and livestock. His book is called Wild Horse Country: The History, Myth, and Future of the Mustang. It's interesting that you sort of take us through the evolutionary saga of the horse, and you describe it as a kind of cast out of Eden story. And I wanted you to say something about this moment. I mean, not one moment, of course, but when the leg bones become fused to allow only forward and backward motions. And this is when you say the horse becomes a design hit. It's like this is when it really gets successful because it starts to get strong and it's really efficient.
Yeah, that's right. This is maybe about 25 million years ago. The world is drying out. Grasses, which had been extremely rare in the era before, are spreading across the earth. And so there's this vast niche of open country. And a couple of different important things happen. One is that you're right. Their leg bones kind of almost fuse in a way so that they are extremely efficient at standing out in the open country and also running in a forward motion. But another important thing happens too, which is that they get a tooth. It's the fancy name for it is hypsodonty, but basically they get these long grinding teeth in the back of their mouth that act sort of like a mechanical pencil. And that's important because as they grind down this really harsh, gritty grass, it would normally in many animals grind their teeth down to the gums and then you could no longer eat. But what happens in horses is as the tooth grounds down, more tooth comes up out of the jaw. And so they can eat this really gritty grass for 20, 30 years. And that allowed them to live in a lot of places that other animals couldn't. And it allowed them to leave the forests and live in the grasslands.
I mean, and as a species, it made them successful. The giant sloths didn't make it. The mammoths didn't. The mastodons didn't. But horses managed to survive. And in some ways, the book is about how that success of the species, they managed to make it, which is pretty cool.
You know what else is interesting? So they evolved to be this sort of arid land, open country animal that could go long distances to water, that could eat fairly poor forage. And then something unintentional happened that really preserved their spread around the globe. Those traits make them very, very helpful for people because overwhelmingly horses were spread by armies, by invading people, you know. And when you are on the march, you don't have good food. You don't have much water. You can't necessarily rely on things. And if you don't have animals that are extremely tough, they won't make it. And so the toughness of the horse, the fact that you could put it on a ship and send it across the Atlantic, the fact that you could march across Asia with it, you know, brought it to almost every society in the world. Mm-hmm. And there it continued to thrive because it didn't need much to make it. And I think that same trait is why we still have wild horses all over the West. Yeah. They're tough.
I have to say, I love your descriptions of the modern version of the horse when it first appears. This is Equus. And this little factoid you have in the book where some wild horses still today have these remnants of stripes on their legs and on their necks.
Yeah, that's right. Wild horses today, you can find some of these primitive markings, and literally they look like the horses in the cave paintings of southern France. Not a whole lot has changed.
So learning what you did at the Bighorn Basin, you came to believe horses, they do deserve to be counted as native. Whatever we mean by native, you think that they qualify.
Yeah, I think maybe it's sort of a moot point because the horses are here and they're probably not going anywhere. But it helped me because I wanted to know, okay, do they really belong in the land? Can they survive with bighorn sheep and desert tortoises and all these other wild things that I think almost all of us want to see preserved? I think if I thought they couldn't, it would be a much harder choice to try and say, okay, let's find a way to make a place for horses in the West. But I think because there's this evolutionary memory for them, One that we actually don't really understand very well. But I think that that is an argument that, that they have a lasting place, not just in our culture, but in our continent.
So, okay, so that takes care of one of the things you wanted to learn from Ken Rose, this professor of anatomy at Johns Hopkins, one of the leading experts on these early horses. And but the other thing you wanted to learn from him by going there is, as you put it, the how the long history of horses shaped the recent history of wild horses. And I want to talk about that. Take it from there, if you would.
So the question is, if wild horses had disappeared, how did they come back?
Yeah.
And I mentioned before that they came from the Spanish conquistadors, but what they really came from is the love affair, the infatuation that native tribes had with the horse. The horse was seen as a symbol of power. It could cover 100 miles in a day. It was big. It was fierce. It was beautiful. I think we probably all have heard these wild stories of how conquistadors with just a few dozen men could conquer these big civilizations in Latin America, mostly because the natives were so awe-inspired by horses.
Yeah.
So 1680 is an important period because this is right when the Spanish have created a foothold in New Mexico in Santa Fe, and they've established essentially a feudal system where there's a few Spanish lords over the natives there. And of course, the Spanish lords all had horses. In 1580, there was a secret plan hatched and an uprising where almost all of the Spanish were killed by the Pueblo tribes that rose up. The rest of them were driven out all the way back down into Mexico.
Yeah.
And the natives got all of the horses.
And we should say the elites, the Spanish, they tried to keep those horses from themselves. They were really tightly controlled. They didn't want the
right.
natives to get them.
Right. It was a secret weapon. It was literally in the laws that you were not allowed to teach the natives how to ride, because they knew that once they had that power, the Spanish would lose all of their advantage. So in 1680, the Spanish lost all of their advantage. And they never, ever, because of the horse, were able to get it back. Basically, what happened is you got this positive feedback loop where once some of the tribes had horses, the Utes, the Apaches, these were the first to get them, they were able to steal more horses. So they would raid the Spanish again, and then the Spanish would have to call for reinforcements down to Mexico and say, please send more horses and supplies. We've just been raided. And the Apache and the Ute would steal those horses. And then these horses were traded out from tribe to tribe throughout the West. And very quickly, they reached all the way up into Canada, all the way up into the Columbia River area, out into the plains, and really transformed these societies in ways that are complete. You know, changed them not just in how they got from place to place, but changed everything, including their view of how they saw the universe.
I want to have you read a section of the book. You say that looking back, there may be no way to fully appreciate what horses meant to the tribes. Read this section for us, if you will.
Sure, sure. This is just saying a little bit about the transformation that took place. Looking back through the centuries, there may be no way to fully appreciate what horses meant to the tribes, or how potent was the thrill of looking into a horse's eyes, feeling its hot breath, and realizing its strength could be your strength, its speed could be your speed. A horse and rider could be inestimably more than the sum of their parts. For the tribes, it was everything. The distance and space in the West that had once been oppressive and impoverishing suddenly could become a source of power. Vast grasslands that had been deserts could be turned into muscle, speed, wealth, and weapons of war that in the right hand could turn bands of meager scroungers into a fighting force powerful enough to terrorize modern empires and keep both the Spanish and the American armies at bay. Almost every tribe immediately yearned for horses, dreamed of them, sang of them, painted them on canyon walls, named moons in their annual calendar after them, and welcomed them into their cultures so completely that before long they were not sure those horses had not always been there. The Apaches said that the Creator made the horse, using lightning for its breath, rainbows for its hooves, the evening stars for its eyes, crescent moons for its ears, and the whirlwind for its power and speed. The Navajo said that every day the sun god rode across the sky on a turquoise Mustang with a joyous neigh.
I have to say, it's really interesting to see just how quickly the horse makes its way into ritual and myth of
right.
these native
and
people.
Also, I think that this is often forgotten, but it also created whole new cultures.
Yeah.
The Comanche, who may be one of the most famous of the horse nations, the tribes that really embraced the horse, they didn't exist until the horse came along. They had been a people that were of pretty meager meager trappings, living in the high mesas of Wyoming, and they split off from their original tribe because they were the people that embraced the horse completely.
Yeah.
And within a few generations, they owned the entire Southern Plains, and had inestimable wealth. You know, horses in the tens of thousands, and they could strike hundreds of miles down into Mexico on a raiding party and get away, and be 100 miles away within a day or two.
So interesting, because you say before the horse, the Great Plains were mostly empty of people. I mean, the horse changed. Changed that. It changed societies. Those native societies were transformed by the horse.
Right. You know, you can imagine if you're on foot how hard it would be to do anything productive in the open plains. You know, people certainly lived along the river bottoms, mostly people who were farming squash and corn. The Apache actually were farmers before they became raiders. But the horse allowed them to hunt. You know, the images we have of, quote, the Indian
yeah.
is these horse nations that learned to chase the buffalo, the elk, the antelope, that lived on horses, that moved around in teepee villages. None of that really existed in any big way before these horses were stolen from the Spanish.
In fact, you say the tribes that didn't adopt horses in some ways are largely forgotten by history.
Yeah, we don't have any cars named after the Mandan.
Yeah, yeah. So you visited the Turquoise Pueblo, which is not far off the interstate between Santa Fe and Albuquerque. It's right where this Pueblo rebellion begins. Not much in the way of human settlement still around, but there are still horses there, you say. I mean, this is where that great horse dispersal begins, and you notice that even there, they don't really know what to think about or do with these horses.
Right. So it was really interesting. I the details of this uprising that freed the horses were carefully recorded by the Spanish in various letters and trials afterward. And so I knew that part of the plan was hatched at this place called Turquoise Pueblo. And I wanted to go there to just sort of see where the fountainhead had sprung. And there's nothing left. There's a few mounds of what might have been adobe bricks melted into the sagebrush and rabbit brush there. But that culture is gone, or at least that village is. But what was interesting is that the wild horses are still roaming those hills there. And those hills are now kind of the exurbs of Albuquerque, bedrooms communities. And when people move in there and build their ranchettes, all of a sudden they don't want these feral horses wandering around. And there's been some disputes about what to do about them. What do you do with these herds? And a lot of the local people said, these aren't really native horses. These are just strays. These aren't real wild horses. And other people would say, no, you know, they've been here since my grandparents have been here. They've always been here. And so actually, to settle this dispute, the state of New Mexico had these horses genetically tested, because you can pick up some of the old Spanish genes in the horses and find out how long they've been there, or at least, you know, what herds they came from. And it confirmed that these are horses that were stolen by the Indians, were have maybe been roaming free for centuries in these hills.
You tell a story of this dark period in the 1920s, the early part of the 20th century, when this businessman comes up with this plan to give new life to this idle cattle processing plant by using horses for meat instead. Talk a little bit about this era. This was a whole the dog food decades is how you describe it in the book.
Right.
Talk a little bit about this. I mean, the plan is what? They round up these Mustangs how does it work? Yeah.
We talked about the native tribes that spread horses all over the West. And of course, these are our communities that have no barbed wire. And so uncounted horses got loose. Horses that grew into vast wild herds, the herds that the early American settlers described and compared to the buffalo herds, just endless herds that you could ride past for hours on the southern plains. If you look at old maps of Texas, some of the very first maps, they're just huge swaths of the western region that just they've written wild horses across it. It's estimated that there was maybe 2 million wild horses in the West. Now, if you fast forward to the 1950s, there's only a couple thousand left.
Right.
And the question is, what happened?
Yeah.
Where did all these horses go? And there's a lot of answers. They ended up pulling streetcars in Manhattan. They ended up being made into the covers of baseballs. But the big answer is that they got rounded up and put on trains as soon as railroads reached into the West and turned into dog food. And so there was the biggest of these factories, one that slaughtered untold hundreds of thousands of these horses, was the Chappell Brothers kennel ration plant in Illinois. And the owner had taken this defunct cattle slaughterhouse and realized, hey, I can get horses almost for free in the West. They're part of the wild bounty out there, like timber and mining and everything else. And if you can get it to market, the laws at the time essentially let you do whatever you wanted. And so he would hire cowboys out in the West to do drives of wild horses, where they drove them to the railhead, packed them onto cattle cars, and sent them to the slaughterhouse. And he was churning out millions of cans a year, starting in, I think, about 1925, and reaching on throughout the 30s.
It's interesting you write about those early, I'm trying to imagine what those early roundups were like, because you said throughout the history of the West, as long as there have been wild horses on this land, people have been trying to catch them. What were the early ones like? I mean, you write about how it was a thrill for these people that never really wore off.
Yeah. So the earliest method of catching wild horses is the one we probably still think about, is a buckaroo galloping after another horse with his lariat swinging, ready to get it around his neck. And that did happen. In fact, there are some beautiful descriptions of chases like that in the 1830s in the Southern Plains. But that was only really good for catching maybe one horse once in a while. It was difficult. It was dangerous. You were just as likely to ruin your own horse through injury than to get a new and useful horse. And so mostly what people would do and have been doing basically ever since is they would set up big corrals somewhere with a funnel sort of reaching out into the plains, or maybe use a canyon as a funnel. And they would slowly drive horse herds into these areas where they would run into the corral and be trapped. Mm. And then you could take out what you wanted and saddle break it or whatever, depending on what your use is, and domesticate it that way. Now, doing that would never make even the slightest dent on these vast herds.
It was like trying to drain a river with a bucket.
Right. And so there was no change in the population, really, until these industrial efforts took place, where you had the railroads, you had the slaughter factories, and you had these big groups of wage labor cowboys who would bring them in.
Yeah. It's interesting. You also write about the hunts. you mentioned in places settlers would treat horses like coyotes, you know, like varmints. They would just shoot them. You mentioned in Kanab, Utah, ranchers organized hunts every year to go out and kill the horses.
Or at least they tried.
Oh, tried, right.
So, right. So if you are in the livestock business, your bank account is basically the grass that is around you, whether it's cattle or sheep. And every horse that is living on that grass is one less cow or sheep you can put out there. And with these huge herds, the ranchers, understandably so, were desperate to get rid of them. And rounding them up was not always a viable solution because, as everyone in Utah knows, like, the West is some rough country.
Yeah.
It's pretty hard. We're not talking the Great Plains here. It is a hard place to gather herds. And even if you did gather them in Kanab, what the heck are you going to do with them?
Right.
You are far from another market. And so what they would do all over the West is shoot horses. Many states, including Utah, had bounties, just like they did for wolves or coyotes. You could bring in a pair of stallion's ears and get, you know, $20 or something. And the ranchers in Kanab, they had this idea of like, well, let's try and convince people from the East to come out here on guided hunts and shoot horses. And you know, we'll make a little money guiding them, and we'll take care of our horse program or our horse problem. And they actually got a mention of this in the New York Times, saying that it was quite thrilling and you know, anyone should come out and try it if they love to hunt. By the way, I don't have any evidence that many people ever did.
Yeah. Well, they kept getting more and more creative. I mean, you write about how in I think it was in Oregon, they asked the Army to use bombers to try and kill some of the horses.
That's right. And in Nevada, they asked the Army to for a couple months every year come out and practice their maneuvers on the ground against wild horses. Wow. And it just shows how, to the rancher, how vast of a problem this was, that the community could not take care of these big herds of horses that were really interfering with their effort to raise livestock. So at the turn of the 20th century, the wild horse really was seen as tumbleweed by a lot of these stock raisers. The government even called it the range robber, you know, something that would devour what could be put to use by sheep and cattle. And remember, this is the era when we really saw the West as a bounty to be used for man, you know, right, by building dams, by digging mines, by clear cutting. And it wasn't until later that we as a society recognized that there was some value just in the wildness itself.
Let's close the chapter where you write about this horses for meat, because that hasn't really gone away. I mean, for some reason, horse meat is not an option in the United States, but you point out horses are still, like, I think 100,000 American horses a year are still being slaughtered for meat.
Right, right. So I actually don't know why Americans don't eat horses anymore, and I think that a couple generations ago they probably did much more, and
yeah,
you could find it in the supermarket or the butcher shop, I guess, at the time. I think maybe one of the reasons that we've come to find it abhorrent is because it was sometimes sort of switched for beef, and so it became the sign of
the cheap,
you know,
stuff.
Yeah, it became gross. It was an idea that someone's trying to pull something over on you. But also, you know, we have a very strong relationship with horses as a companion animal.
Right.
You know, we don't eat dogs. We don't eat cats. Certainly, horses have been afforded the same level of humanity as those companion animals. And so that's a big part of it. And in the last 20 years or so, there's been a big fight to get rid of the remaining slaughterhouses for horses in the United States. And so now, by law, there are none. But that hasn't taken away a market. There are still people with unwanted horses that would like to sell them to someone. And so we ship, as you said, about 100,000, maybe a little more, horses every year to both Mexico and Canada. And there, they're generally slaughtered, frozen, and shipped to Europe and Asia, where they're eaten.
So an important part of the book is you come to, as you put it, casting about for an alternative to these roundups and these other methods of horses. And you come to – I want to talk about the two alternatives that you come to toward the end of the book. We don't have a lot of time to talk about this first one, but say something about PZP, which is basically you have a lot of optimism about this particular method. It's basically birth control. It's a birth control pill for horses.
Right. So we passed a law to protect wild horses in 1971. At that point, there was maybe 20,000 horses left in the West. And the idea was that we would let them live in these tiny remaining scraps where they still were and protect them like endangered species. Well, very soon the herd started increasing, but their land did not. So the government said, okay, we need to keep a sustainable population on the land, and when the herds get too big, we will remove them, rounding them up with helicopters. That has created a big problem because they don't know what to do with the horses that they remove. Yeah. They try to get them adopted, and very few people want to adopt them. And so what they've been doing for the last 15 years or so, a little more, is storing them on private ranches in the Midwest. And so we pay oftentimes very wealthy landowners in the Midwest millions and millions of dollars a year to store these horses that we've removed from the wild. It's not sustainable. Yeah. The government program is basically paralyzed because it's spending so much money on storing horses that it can't actually take care of the herds in the West. And so for years, they've been looking for another way to approach this problem of how do you control the population. And one that a scientist in Montana, Jay Kirkpatrick, mm-hmm. really championed and developed was PZP. Yeah. PZP is basically, like you said, it's birth control. It comes in a dart. It lasts for a year. And it works very well. And he presented it to the Bureau of Land Management, which oversees all wild horses, 20 years ago. And they said, this is great. This is going to fix all of our problems. Mm-hmm. We're going to start using this right now. And they never did. Yeah. And they never have. They've used it in tiny numbers in places, but never enough to control populations. And so the helicopter roundups have continued. Now, there are people all over the West, community groups, including in Utah, that have said, wait a minute. Shooting a dart at these horses once a year is such a better, more cost-effective, more humane alternative. If the government isn't going to do it, we will. Yeah. And in maybe a dozen places in the West, they are actively controlling these populations through fertility control is what they call it. And it works. And they do it all through volunteers, and it's really amazing. But the government, unfortunately, has backed itself into a corner where it's spent so much money storing horses that it no longer has any money to figure out how to not store horses.
It's interesting you write this in the book. You say that learning about PZP was really interesting, but it left you uninspired. That's how you put it. You say the vaccine may be practical, but it's not beautiful. Explain what you mean.
It took me a while to admit this to myself because I wanted to find a solution that would stop these ridiculous and inefficient helicopter roundups. And so I thought, these drugs, here it is. Yeah. You know, we can dart these horses, keep track of them, control the population. But what I eventually realized is that we didn't protect the wild horse because of the horse. We protected it because we valued the wild. Like I said, that symbol of liberty that embodies our nation. And so that can't exist really in any real inspiring way with a tightly controlled population that you're darting every year. You know, it's no longer wild. At that point, it's a figurine that you just happen to have out in the field. Yeah. And so I wanted to find something else that could both control the numbers, because that's a real pressing need, and preserve this wildness that is the reason that we love wild horses in the first place.
So, of course, in that search for this solution, this gets you to the border of California, Nevada, in Montgomery Pass. And I honestly feel like I want to do a drum roll here. Here's the solution. And this seems crazy, but here's the solution. Mountain lions.
Right. Seems obvious. In fact, at the beginning of my journey researching this book, it was one of the things that I asked, you know, some of the horse advocates and government specialists. Well, why don't we just let predators take care of this?
Yeah.
And it's a question that many people ask. So many, in fact, that it's become like this flag that marks you as an idiot who knows nothing about the issues.
Yeah.
And what the government will tell you is, look, wild horses have no natural predators because they are an introduced species. Mountain lions cannot hunt a wild horse. They're too big. They're too fast. And besides, wild horses live out in open country where mountain lions won't hunt. So don't even bother with your stupid idea. Thank you very much. Please sit down. And so for years, while I was doing my research, I put that aside. And then just by trying to research other things, I read all of the scientific literature on wild horses in the West. And one thing that struck me over and over is that some biologist would go into the field to study some herd and as a footnote would note, oh, by the way, we were trying to study X in the population, but that was difficult because we think many of the herd were eaten by mountain lions. Or, alternatively, you'd find someone who was trying to research mountain lions and their relationship with deer in Nevada. Yeah. And the poor biologist would say, well, you know, I was out there for months and studied this, but it didn't really work. And I even collared these mountain lions. But what I found is that mostly the mountain lions ate horses, not deer. And so there was all this data that had been found accidentally, stumbled upon, but then put aside because oftentimes the scientists were looking for something else. And yet repeatedly there it was again and again and again that mountain lions do eat wild horses. And so I went to Montgomery Pass because it was the only place where someone had actually tried to look at that on purpose, that relationship between the lion and the horse and what it meant. And it led me to a biologist named John Turner, who'd been studying this herd up on this range of mountains right on the border, literally between California and Nevada, where a wild horse herd had been held in check, in natural balance, by mountain lions for years and years, and had been documented. And the information was there, and no one was really paying any attention to it.
It's such a great story, but it reveals the conflicts again in the West. You mentioned the BLM is in this really strange position because on one hand, it controls livestock, but on the other hand, it doesn't control wildlife. And so you have these interests, the same interests that want to wipe out predators are frustrated about Mustangs. So it's a very strange place.
Right. So I almost tore my hair out over this. So we spend about $60 million a year removing wild horses from the West. At the same time, the same federal government that's paying that bill pays to remove predators from the West, millions of dollars to remove predators, and surprising numbers. So in 2014 in the West, state or federal government killed 3,000 mountain lions. So all that money that we're spending to remove lions is just creating more of an expense in removing horses. And so obviously you would say, well, we need to tell the federal government to stop working against itself. But it's not so easy because, as you said, often the states control the mountain lions, either the states or the Federal Division of Wildlife. That's an entirely different agency from the Bureau of Land Management, which controls the horses. You would need some real leadership at a high level to get those two to talk to each other and work something out. And so far that has not happened.
Do you think we're at a turning point on this issue, on the question of what we're going to do with wild horses in the West?
I think we're in a crisis point, but I don't know how it's going to turn. I say it's a crisis point because The government goal for a sustainable population is about 27,000 horses. And right now, because they've been unable to keep up with their helicopter removals, we have about 75,000 horses in the West, and the number's going up. Something is going to happen that cannot last. Now, a couple different things could happen. The population could naturally crash on the land, which is not just bad for the horses, but could be devastating for everything involved, yeah, because they will eat their areas down to the ground, and all of the native species, large and small, will also suffer. And the arid West takes a long time to recover. So that's one possibility. Another is that Congress could decide to sell them off, all the extra horses, sell them to slaughter. If they decided to do that, it would be cost-effective and relatively simple and extremely controversial.
Yeah.
Not easy to do, and all efforts in the past have led to violence. So that should give them pause. And then looking at mountain lions is probably the hardest thing to do, and will take time and real effort and real leadership, which I'm not sure we have right now. But I don't see any other option that's really palatable.
David Phillips. His book is Wild Horse Country: The History, Myth, and Future of the Mustang. David, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you. Glad to be on.
David joined us from a studio in Colorado Springs. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.